From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the February 2015 edition of the Bletchley Park podcast, telling the world. This month, seven stalwarts of secrecy lift the lid at last as they help launch a new book telling their stories and those of another 38 women who worked for the Government Code and Cipher School during World War II. But first, the best-selling author, journalist and TV presenter Ben McIntyre is one of an ever-growing list of prestigious speakers who've given talks in the Bletchley Park Presents lecture series. He held a sold-out audience captive with his fascinating true story of Kim Philby, history's most famous traitor. Philby was the most notorious British defector and Soviet mole in history. Agent, double agent, traitor, an enigma, he betrayed every secret of Allied operations to the Russians in the early years of the Cold War. Ben told the story of his intimate bond with and systematic betrayal of his two closest friends in the intelligence world. So, how did you first get into the subject of spies?
How did I start with spying? I guess it was really Agent Zigzag that set me off on this trail. I got a call from a friend who was in the intelligence services who alerted me to the fact that a huge file relating to Agent Zigzag was being released. And this was all the wartime files from Eddie Chapman, who was our great double agent during the Second World War. And that kind of set me off on the spy trail. I had never really intended to write about spies, although I've always been interested in spies. The lovely thing about writing about spies is that you can kind of cover the sort of areas of life that are usually covered by novelists, except that you don't have to make anything up. There are issues of loyalty and love and betrayal and treachery and drama and romance within the kind of espionage world that you don't really get anywhere else.
Well, a spy's work is never just his work, it's his whole life, isn't
that's
it?
Right.
It's a whole web of deceit.
That's
you talked
right.
a lot about friendship today in the case of Kim Philby, that was very important, wasn't it? Tell me a bit about
Absolutely
him.
Absolutely vital. I mean, also, the spy world is essentially about personality and character. During wartime, it is obviously about military aspects and so on as well. But in the essence, it boils down to a story about how human beings interact with each other. So you end up with a kind of psychological story. And that's what I loved about the Kim Philby story, is that really, at essence, it's a story about a very old-fashioned sort of British friendship and a rather male friendship of a sort that we don't really discuss very much these days. And indeed, it sounds rather antique, really. But at the core of the Philby story is this sort of solid friendship that enabled Philby really to manipulate his way into, you know, the crown jewels of British intelligence.
Well, wouldn't they call it a bromance now?
They might call it a bromance.
Do you think that diminishes it slightly?
I think it probably does, really. I think it was a traditional kind of old-fashioned, clubbable male friendship based on kind of sport and drink and jokes. I mean, it wasn't a profound relationship. They weren't discussing their feelings or their emotions. They were rather old-fashioned Englishmen in that way.
Well,
they
heaven didn't... forbid, yes.
Yeah, no, you know, I mean, and in fact, in a funny way, I think part of the bond was that you didn't really talk about things that were close to your heart or close to your genuine feelings, because it was a way of kind of bonding without having to be emotional. These were people who found emotion very difficult, I think.
So tell me a little bit, for anyone who hasn't read the book or hasn't heard today's talk, tell me a little bit about the web of deception he wove around him and how he got away with it for so long.
Well, Philby sort of got away with it because he managed to do what no intelligence officer has ever done before, or to my knowledge since, which was that he not only got in to the enemy camp, he managed to end up running a large chunk of the enemy camp. He actually managed to get in and become a very senior intelligence officer within British intelligence while all the time working for, first of all, the NKVD, Stalin's intelligence service, and then latterly the KGB. To my knowledge, no one else has ever really managed to do that, certainly from that side. And so it gave him a unique purchase, really. It meant that he could see the danger to himself coming.
And how was he taken apart and brought down? How did it come about?
Well, it happened in sort of two stages, really. The defection of Guy Burgess and Donald MacLean, his close friends from Cambridge, who were also fellow spies for the KGB. When they defected, because the net was closing in on Donald MacLean, it then became very dangerous for Philby. He became a target, and he knew he was going to become a target. And he then had a choice, really. He could either try and brazen it out, or he could run for it. And he seriously considered making a run for it at that point, 1951. But he calculated that actually he could probably tough it out with the MI5 interrogators, that he could sort of hold his line, and they didn't have enough information to get him. He was forced out of MI6, but he was not prosecuted. And so that was the first time. And then the second time was really when an MP stood up in the House of Commons and exposed him as the third man, identified him as being the third man. But they were premature because actually, they didn't have enough evidence. And so Philby really called on the government to either prosecute him or exonerate him, which left them with no choice but to exonerate him.
I love the story you told about how his press conference is still used as a training tool at MI6 today, because it's so convincing.
Yeah, I mean, they show it to young recruits, this extraordinary footage of Philby staring down the camera lens and lying his head off. And they say, you know, what can you tell about this man that tells you that he's lying? Some people claim that if you look very closely, at one point he puts his tongue in his cheek. He literally does a kind of a tongue-in-cheek gesture, as if to indicate that what he is saying is complete nonsense and not the truth. But nobody at the time spotted that. I think if he did that, and I'm not sure he really did, I think it was just a nervous reaction, but if he did it, that was a signal for his Russian handler.
The depth of deception is staggering, isn't it?
It is. I think Philby became
the greatest double agent that ever was.
Yeah, I think that is true. I don't think anyone else either pulled it off to such a depth or for so long. The thing about Philby is he became sort of addicted to it. He became a kind of addict of infidelity, and he couldn't really stop himself after a while. I think he found that he was sort of stuck in this sort of romance of being a double agent. And I think he loved it too. I mean, don't get me wrong, I think he sort of found it extremely exhilarating to be the person who was kind of manipulating others. And he was a sort of born manipulator. But also there is the sort of drug of infidelity here. I mean, and you can see it in his private life as well. He was sort of consistently and pathologically unfaithful to his wives, one after the other. And when he landed up in Moscow, having defected, he really didn't know anyone in Moscow except for Donald MacLean, his old friend. And he got friendly with Donald MacLean and his wife. And then Donald MacLean used to work late in the job that he'd been given by the Russian state. And so Philby immediately began having an affair with his wife. That was the one person, the only other couple they knew in Moscow. And his first act was to betray his only friend.
It's built into his very character, clearly, isn't it?
Yeah, he was. David Cornwell once said to me, John le Carré said to me, that Kim Philby was the sort of person you'd go out for an evening with them. And then you'd go home and then your wife would reveal that halfway through the evening, Kim Philby had passed her a napkin on which he'd written, "Shall we meet at the Savoy afterwards for a drink?" I mean, he was completely unstoppable.
Shameless. It must have been quite embarrassing for the authorities.
Shattering. Yeah. I think it created a sort of cataclysmic explosion within British intelligence that took a generation to heal, and arguably still hasn't healed. I mean, the discovery that they had been made such fools of for so long because of their own willful blindness had a really seriously traumatic effect. On the other hand, you can argue that actually, in the end, it led to a change in the way that British intelligence worked. It no longer does MI5 and MI6 recruit through the old boy network. It's no longer enough to have the right accent and have been to the right school. You know, there are very many more careful checks and balances that make sure that people who, mad people and fantasists as well as active spies, don't get through the net. So you could argue that Philby actually did us a favour. I mean, he would have hated that thought, but actually Philby helped to transform British intelligence.
It was a painful favour, but ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, perhaps it was that kind of catharsis, the jolt that the whole system needed to move it out of what was really a kind of pre-war idea of, you know, if you looked right and you wore the right tie, that you were somehow necessarily on the right side, which Philby emphatically proved was not the case.
You, I take it, have seen The Imitation Game.
I have.
What do you make of it?
Well, I love the game. I love the Imitation Game. I think it's absolutely brilliant drama. I mean, there are bits of the history that you can take issue with, but then it's not a documentary, so why does it have to worry about that?
What do you make of the Cairn Cross story in that? Or the way they wove some of that into
it? I thought it was fascinating. I don't quite believe that is what Cairn Cross was doing when he was at Bletchley Park. He very carefully covered his tracks about what he was actually up to, and I don't think it was as straightforward as they made it sound. But this is drama. It's not supposed to be a kind of PhD. It's supposed to get the emotional aspect of it right. I mean, the one person I thought who comes off rather unfairly is old Denniston, who's turned into a kind of ferocious sort of militaristic figure, which I don't think he was really.
Well, I heard it described quite nicely in that he represents authority in that role.
Yeah.
And that's Turing clashing against authority. As you say, it's not a documentary. Yeah. That's the key thing.
Yeah. I think it'll bring thousands of people into Bletchley Park, which is great.
Well, yes, exactly. What's next for you?
I am writing the authorised history of the SAS. I've been commissioned by the SAS to do their wartime history, which is fascinating, which is access to their secret archive. They have an archive of material which has no historian's ever been through completely. So that's incredibly exciting and good fun. It's a different sort of world, although it has elements of the same sort of skullduggery and espionage, because the SAS, in a way, rather brilliantly straddles intelligence work and active combat operations. And they're an extraordinary group of people.
Why have they decided to lift the lid on that now?
Well, I think it's part of a general sort of movement towards openness on the part of all sorts of institutions that have remained closed and silent for decades. Really, in a way, they're following the footsteps of MI5 and MI6, both of whom have now published authorised histories. I think there's a general feeling now that actually maintaining secrecy for secrecy's sake is really rather counterproductive, and it doesn't actually help any. It doesn't keep secrecy any safer, and you know, the wartime history of the SAS doesn't really expose any secrets about the way the SAS operates today. So I think they're keen to get their story out.
Well, let's hope you don't get your first draft in and then find only half of it comes back.
Yes, or indeed if I end up in a ditch with a bullet in my head, you'll know that I got the recipe wrong.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Bletchley Park Presents continues into 2015, with tickets on sale now for Michael Smith, Victor Madeira, Jerry White, Taylor Downing and Sinclair Mackay. Dates and details are on our website, and more speakers will be announced soon. This Valentine's Day, Saturday the 14th of February, everyone with an MK postcode can get into Bletchley Park free. Bring proof of address, and while you're here, please tell us what you think of the £8 million restoration of this historic site. Two new books tell the stories of the women of Bletchley Park, who made up two-thirds of the workforce during World War II. In Bletchley Girls, Tessa Dunlop captures their extraordinary journeys into an adult world of war, secrecy, love and loss. In The Debs of Bletchley Park and Other Stories, best-selling author and Bletchley Park's chief historical advisor, Michael Smith, reveals the secrets held for at least 30 years by women including a former ballerina, a convent girl, and a student of German literature, as well as the debutantes of the title. They told Michael what it was like to be a young woman at Bletchley Park during World War II, and talked not just about their work, but about every aspect of their lives. Seven of them gathered in the mansion to tell the world's media too.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're ready now. I'm sorry to keep you waiting, but obviously the stars of the show are the ladies, not me. So I'm going to introduce them in a minute. What I want really to say is that in this book, I wanted to describe the war through the eyes of the women. There are three men quoted in this book. Just three men. The rest of the book is done largely from quotations from women. The three men are Neville Chamberlain, Winston Churchill, and the husband of one of the women, who describes meeting her in the theatre when they were doing a rehearsal for a review, and he'd written the sketch that she was in. She was a professional actress, in fact, before she came here. And he says that he saw this vision of loveliness stepped down from the stage. And I thought that was such a good quote that I wasn't going to leave that one out. But he's the only male codebreaker who gets a quote in this book, because the story, as you know, is the women. And so I'm going to introduce them. First of all, Lady Marion Boddy, who worked on Japanese codes in a fairly complex way, in the sense that she had to make sure the intercept stations were taking all of the right signals to get all of the messages, because one station would send on one frequency, another station would reply on another frequency, and you needed both sides. So it's that sort of thing. I'm sure it's far more complicated than that. She insists it was very boring, but she also, of course, famously worked with the Duchess of Cambridge's grandmother and great aunt. They were close friends. They'd been recruited from the same secretarial college. Next to her is Jean Pitt Lewis, who was one of Dilly's girls. This is amazing for us because Dilly was one of the great codebreakers here, and he surrounded himself with women, largely because he didn't like the testosterone of the new young men who were coming in and wanted to do everything their way. Dilly was very set in his ways, and he knew what he was doing. So thankfully, Alistair Denniston, who was in charge, decided he should have his own unit and surrounded him with women. And thankfully, that helps my book, of course, but it also means that we've got one of Dilly's girls here, Jean Pitt Lewis. And next to her, we have one of our star veterans, I have to say. Betty Webb has been here so often and done so many wonderful things for us, and we're very grateful. And Betty worked on Japanese codes, but she also worked here in the mansion on German police codes, which was an important thing because that told us the start of the Holocaust. And now we have two women who worked in the Numeri. They worked in one of the star exhibits here, the Colossus computer. They worked the world's first digital electronic computer, which is just up the road in the National Museum of Computing, rebuilt by Tony Sale. Marigold Freeman Atwood and Margaret Mortimer both worked on this. And Jean Cocker worked in the naval section. She worked on a huge plot of the whole world, which had all of the German, Japanese, Italian, and British, and American, and Russian ships on it. Every Allied ship, every enemy ship was on there. And obviously, they're plotting it for the war, but one of the key things for some of the women here who had boyfriends on ships going across dangerous waters was that the women in the plot were able to tell them that the ship was still safe. So please put your hand up and say who you are and which organisation you come from.
I think I did know pretty well what we were supposed to be doing. Of course, you couldn't get the whole picture, but the word ultra was the code word that we used, and when I was typing out signals ready to be sent all over the world, they were all marked ultra, and that was a word you must never use again because it only applied to Bletchley Park. So, of course, it was difficult, and we never spoke, even as we came over to this room and had a cup of coffee. We wouldn't have spoken about what we were doing. And in fact, when you left your room, you always shut the door very firmly and quickly, and you never ever visited any other room. So there was very little opportunity to find out what was going, but yes, I did know the principle of it.
I'm here with Michael Smith, the author of The Debs of Bletchley Park and Other Stories. What made you write this book?
I was asked to write a book on the Debs of Bletchley Park, and I said no, because there weren't that many. People talk about the Debs as if they were all Debs. They weren't. But I will write a book on the women of Bletchley Park, because I think that their story is important. I think we see everything because of the era that we're talking about. We see everything from a male perspective because that's the way the world was seen in those days. We always talk about the women at Bletchley Park being small cogs in a much bigger machine, and that's true to some extent, but if you take the cogs out, the machine doesn't work. Everything they did was just as important.
within the whole thing. And, of course, some of the women were, in fact, leading codebreakers, and at every level, not just leading codebreakers, but the level below that, a large number of the people doing the job were women. And the further you went down from the top codebreaker level, the more women were doing it, and the majority of people doing that job were women.
What restricted them in getting higher levels?
There were some senior women in other roles, largely roles where women were seen as being the key people to do the job. So, for example, within the Hart 4 filing system, Pamela Rose, as she now is, was actually a temporary senior administrative officer, which is very, very high up within the civil service at this place. You know, that was the highest rank, really, for an ordinary worker here. So some women did get right to the top, but it was largely in jobs, in what might be termed women's jobs. And, of course, the other thing is that the large number of men fighting meant that most of the people here had to be women anyway. The Treasury tried to keep them in junior ranks because that was cheaper. At one point, Commander Travis, the head of Bletchley Park, said to Joan Clark, "I think we might have to make you a wren, put you in the wrens, if we're going to pay you anything like what you need." So a junior wren working on a bomb was paid more than Joan Clark, who was one of the leading codebreakers. So it's a bizarre sort of situation.
Did you tackle this book differently to how you've tackled other books?
Yes, definitely so. I went out of my way to say, right, I'm going to make this book open to a much broader audience. I'm going to dispense with all the techie stuff. I'm going to tell you what Colossus was, but I'll tell you it in very simple terms. I am going to tell you what the bomb was, but I'll tell you in very simple terms, and I won't waste too much of your time reading about that, because you're probably more interested in what this wren has to say, or what this female codebreaker has to say, because actually, as we found out today, they're the interesting people.
That's it, isn't it? It's saying enough. It's actually quite hard to describe those technical machines very simply, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's quite a skill.
It's something that has to be done, though, if you're going to broaden the appeal of Bletchley out to a wider audience. And people will be upset by that, because people, of course, who spend a long time working out the technical detail and understand it and very keen on it, feel somehow that something has been stolen from them if you tell the story simply so that lots of other people can understand it. But there's no point in telling a story if you're going to keep talking to, you know, say, a million people, when you can tell it simply and talk to 10 million people.
Of all the stories and the anecdotes you've put together, was there a particular area that you hadn't previously explored in that depth that really captured your imagination?
That's a very interesting question. I think the one area that I set out to explore, which hadn't really struck me, was what they did after the war and the very great difference between what some of them did and what others did. You know, so some of them would go off and do something spectacular after all. Others just felt, well, I've done my bit. And that was all great fun, and that was interesting. But now, reverting to type is the wrong way to put it, but it is almost that. It's almost a sort of reversion to what my mother would want me to do. So I get a husband, I get married, I get a family, you know, I get a house. And, of course, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But for some of them, it may not have been the right option, and they regretted it. A lot of those marriages broke up, you know, fairly quickly.
I think that's it, isn't it? Sort of, it gave people more options, didn't it, as well, the war? You
once
could go
once
on.
Once you've seen that wider world, that simple life, which seemed so idyllic before, suddenly becomes really closed in around you. You're left at home with a young kid and your husband's out at work, and one of them described it as you felt like you were going mad, you know.
Oh, gosh.
And I think the other thing about that is that it's something I think young women can identify with now, even now, same situation.
And discovering these new avenues, you know, as a researcher, you know, there's all these spider webs of further research you can sort of take. Has anything inspired you for what's next?
I know that someone wants me to write another book on Bletchley Park. I have written so many. I wonder, it has to end at some stage. And I'm really in the final stages of a novel which is already written, but which my agent wants me just to add a few tiny bits. And I feel very guilty because this book has held that up. And so I'm going to get on with the novel. Second World War, one of the main characters is a woman working in a very secret job.
So that's top secret. We're not telling anybody else.
No, you've got that to yourself. You and the internet.
Me and the internet, absolutely. Shh, you heard it here first. Thank you, Michael.
The veil of secrecy was lifted in July 1975. And it just so happened that I was in the street in Birmingham and one of the former Bletchley members was walking up the other side of the street and she just said, "It's out." I said, "What's out?" And she said, "Well, you can now talk about Bletchley." So I said, "Oh," but I didn't. And it was many, many years after that that I felt free to speak, although officially I was free to speak. As with many of us, my parents never knew because they both died well before 1975. And it's something which you might think is difficult to do, but having signed the Official Secrets Act and you know that you mustn't say anything, you do keep it to yourself, even though it's quite hard work when you're 18 and you haven't experienced anything like it before. But I just said to myself, "Betty, you keep everything inside here, and that's the end of it. There is no question."
You talked a little bit about your interview with Dilly. Can we just sort of go over that a little bit? So how did you get called up for that interview? Did you receive a letter?
You see, I just cannot remember. I think it must have been something that my parents organised, because my mother was very involved with the women's section of the British Legion, and my father was a doctor, and he had a big country practice. And of course, Dilly came from Bucks, as did I. And my father also, he had a patient whose daughter worked here, Phyllida Cross, I think she's mentioned actually.
Yes.
In...
Yes, she was in the cottage.
And her family were patients of my father's.
Oh, I see.
So whether that is the connection, I simply don't know.
So where did this interview take place?
It took place in my home, my parents' house. As I say in the book, actually, that Michael quoted, I didn't get off to a very good start because I was still in bed when Dilly arrived. I think he must have arrived much earlier than expected. I had a terrible cold. I mean, normally, being a doctor's daughter, we were told, "Don't fuss, get on with it," sort of thing, but my mother had taken pity on me. So I wasn't really quite prepared. But I don't remember an awful lot about the interview, because Dilly could be wonderfully vague himself.
So when you arrived at the cottage that first day, what springs to your mind? What sort of memories?
I suppose I was only in the cottage for a very short while. I came in February 42.
Yes.
I can't remember when we moved into one of the huts, but I don't think I was in the cottage an awfully long time. I do just remember that sort of sitting at a table in, I don't know, it can't have been the immediate in from the door. I couldn't remember, in fact, that it was the cottage when I first came back here 2 or 3 years ago. I thought I was in a hut, but I did remember walking up a couple of steps to get into this, so I thought, well, they must have demolished the hut, but then I realised that it was the cottage I was in. But I just don't remember. Somebody must have shown me what to do, I suppose.
And what were you doing?
Well, I was using Dilly's wonderful system of these sort of rods that had keyboard top line. We were using those, and that was how we did break the codes each day, which of course varied.
And so were you given certain letters to try, certain words to try when you were setting up your rods?
I can't remember quite how we did it. This is my problem. I've forgotten how we did it, but I know What we were trying to do was to find repeating couples of letters. And once we had a sort of three or four couples that were the same, then that showed us something was right. But what and how it went from there, I simply cannot remember.
Can you remember any of the people you worked with in the cottage? Because it was quite a small group, wasn't it?
It was a small group, but I can't. Names might jump out if I saw them written. But I mean, I was, a very naive 17-year-old. And you know, everybody else was very senior. I knew, but they probably didn't know me, Mavis and Margaret Rock and Peter Twin, and I knew them because they were the senior members of the group, really.
And did you sort of mingle? Was there a good sort of camaraderie, or did you sort of have your sort of section?
You know, I think we were fairly individual there, actually. It was later when we moved into one of the huts that one became, we were working in bigger groups. But as to the group I was actually working with in the cottage, I haven't got the remotest recollection, I'm afraid. I'm not being terribly vague for you.
No, it's absolutely fine, but it's all sort of little clues, isn't it, that come together. And do you find that as you talk about it, you remember more?
I do try to, and I've read quite a few of the books, some of which I think are fairly accurate, some I have my doubts about, to be quite honest.
I have it in my mind, you know, that it was kind of quite a disorganised, you know, almost like Dilly's brain, the cottage, you know, piles of paper and things like that. How do you remember it? Do you remember the cottage being quite sort of organised and efficiently run, or is it this sort of...
The cottage itself, I have very little recollection of the work in the cottage, actually, at all.
So it's when you went to the huts?
And then when we went to the huts, we were working in... I mean, the section had grown quite a bit, and it became a bit more. And then eventually we moved out to one of the blocks, and that was, again, very much bigger, recruiting more people. And there were a few men folk about at that time too when we got over.
Yes, because in the early stages it was mostly women, wasn't it?
Yes, I got rather a good sort of rhyme that somebody did about Dilly's, what he have done without... Well, it was mostly Mavis and Margaret, what would he have done without his girls?
Oh, really?
Yes.
Ah.
Can't remember where I got it from. Somebody must have given it to me at some point.
So where were you billeted when you were here?
When I first came, I was in Stony Stratford, and that I know was arranged by my mother. So she must have known where I was going to end up. I was going to be working in Bletchley. But she's definitely arranged that through her British Legion work. I was billeted with the Baptist minister and his wife.
And do you remember much about when Dilly went off? Because he was off sick when you arrived,
yes,
wasn't he?
Yes, he was not a well man, no. I really didn't know him awfully well. I said I had this interview and I had one hair-raising drive. He took me home one of my sort of... We worked, of course, 6 days a week, but we could accumulate 3 days leave, you see, work 3 weeks and have 3 days off. And as I say, he also lived in Box, so he agreed to... I don't know how it came about. He must have just mentioned it or knew I was going, and he said he'd take me. Fortunately, Mrs. Dilly was in the car because his driving was as eccentric as he was. So I think, in fact, it's in Michael's book. Mrs. Dilly said she did think, Dilly, I do think it would be a good idea if you had one hand on the steering wheel. You know, that was his... he was very explicit with his hands.
Oh, so he talked a lot. Yes. I do that too. And did you stay there till the end of the war?
I was in Stony Stratford for about 18 months, I think. And then I think I'd grown up a bit, you know, and I felt I would like to be a bit more independent, really. I mean, they were terribly kind, and it must have been awful. They had a 15-year-old son. It must have been awful doing shifts and people coming in at funny times and wanting meals at funny times. But I went into the hostel. We had a hostel just outside the main gates.
Oh, yes, at the end of the road.
Yes.
Of Wilton Avenue.
That's it, yes. And I was there for about 6 months.
Oh, and what was it like?
It was all right, I think. If you weren't used to too much high living, it was perfect, it was adequate. And I don't know why people say the food was bad, because I don't think it was. No. I think the catering was really very good in the cafeteria.
And there was a war on.
Well, exactly.
And did you take part in a lot of the social activities?
Well, I'm afraid I was bone lazy as far as being educated by joining the right groups. But I used to play quite a lot of tennis, which I enjoyed. They had the tennis courts. And we had dances every, I don't remember if it was one a month or one a week, but if we were on the right shift, you could just go in for an evening. It's just known as the hop. I mean, you didn't have to go in with a partner. I didn't bother with boyfriends here at all, actually. We had one chap in our section who, at one time, his name was Victor, and he did try dating, I think, every girl in the section, and nobody was in the least bit interested in him.
He probably thought he was in luck there and then fell fast.
Which was really rather bad luck, because he was quite a nice chap. But
did you make any lasting friends from your section?
Yes, I did. Yes, a very good friend until very recently, actually.
And what was her name?
Her name was Zoe Stent. We were good friends for quite a few years, but sort of drifted apart. Yeah.
And one last question. What did you do after you left Bletchley?
Well, I joined the Fannies, which was due to one of the other girls in the section, who we'd had talks from various, you know, we knew we were going to be made redundant at the end of the war in Europe, and we'd had a talk about the Fannies, and this girl was determined she was going to, and she kept on, and I think three of us, we got so fed up with her, we said eventually, oh, all right, we'll come down to the Labour Exchange with you and sign on. And I feel guilty to this day, because I then rang my parents and said, oh, by the way, I'm going to join the Fannies to go out to Ceylon. Well, I mean, the war was still on. And I, as I say, I feel guilty to this day, the way I broke it to them. And, you know, it seemed a good idea at the time. And I did actually get out to Ceylon,
wow,
which was where I met my husband, in fact.
And that is another story.
Absolutely.
I would like to say thank you for speaking to me. I know other people are keen, so thank you ever so much, and enjoy the rest of your day.
Well, it's a good rubbish I talk,
not
I'm afraid.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Luke Walpole from The Oxford Student. After kind of a lifetime of secrecy, is it now a relief that you can talk more about it, or has it just become second nature to not talk about it?
It became second nature. When you shut the door and came off watch, that was it. A curtain came down. Even to your best friends, even if you were taking a walk in the park at Woburn Abbey, you would never, ever mention what you were doing. And we didn't until my great friend Catherine Payton, also a Wren of Bletchley, was running her own bookshop. She rang me up and she said, we're selling a book on Bletchley. Do you think we could tell our mothers now what we were doing? So we did.
I was sent a copy of the book and I have read it from cover to cover, because I think it's absolutely fascinating. But being asked to come back today is really rather strange.
And have you been back to Bletchley?
Oh, yes, I have. I've been to three of the reunions, only three. And I also came back when Colossus was rebuilt and the Duke of Kent came to switch it on. And quite a group of us came back then to sort of look at it, and I was just saying a moment ago, actually, that looking at the machine, it was so familiar, having worked on it, you know, hour after dreary hour. We looked at it, and not a single one of us could remember precisely what we did. We could all remember odd little bits, And one person would say, oh, we used to do so-and-so over there. Did we? I'm sure I never did that. And we just, no, I remember we used to do something up there, you know, this horrible bit front of the machine. And other people didn't remember. So it was all rather strange because, I mean, we were bound for life, never to mention it. So I think your brain just doesn't bother to hold on to anything. It's no good even sort of lying in bed reminiscing to yourself because it doesn't mean a thing. So I think most of us, all of us, I should imagine, couldn't remember.
I think that's the thing. Most of the ladies that we talk to say exactly the same thing. I think because it was so set in your mind that you were never going to be able to talk about this, you didn't need to remember it, did you? And straight after the war, you had a life to get on with because you'd put your life on hold, hadn't you, really?
I suppose that's the point, yeah.
Working on Colossus, I suppose it was more the environment you would remember, the poor lighting and the smell and things.
The smell, the hard floor, the permanent electric light because that blackout was always over the windows and general heat because, I mean, with all those valves and so on, it gave up quite a bit of heat.
We've interviewed a couple of ladies and one, I think, she started having really bad headaches. She'd had to go off into convalescence because of the lights.
I'm not surprised, yes. Not a bit surprised. We all had to have good eyesight. There were no glasses or anything like that. And we all had to be a certain height to be able to reach up and do things.
Oh, of course, yeah.
But apart from that, I think they said you should have taken school cert with a credit in maths. Well, that was a total waste of time. You didn't need a credit in maths or anything else. But anyway, I suppose that just meant you'd had a certain length of education, at least, you know, minimum. But
so in reality, you were one of the world's first computer operators.
And last, in my case, I've got a computer. Well, I suppose we were. We didn't know that at the time. It didn't mean anything to us. It was just this machine. It was called Colossus, and we worked. All these other things have come out much, much later. In fact, I'm still learning heaps all the time.
Well, we are. The part of the museum is all the time we're learning things, and we learn things from people like you. That's the importance of capturing these stories of people like you. Because
sorry, it's too late. Yes.
Well, unfortunately, well, yes.
Know,
and a lot of our lovely veterans say that, you know, you've got to hurry up now.
I know.
But, you know, you're all so willing to share these stories with us, and it's just so we can teach the next generation, really, isn't it?
Well, yes, it is, yes. And I do think it's important that the memory should go on and not be wiped out, because it really was terribly important to the war effort.
Well, that's the fundamental reason that Bletchley Park is here, is so we can keep your stories alive of what you people did for us and the service that you gave to your country.
Yes, yes. Of course, it was never, ever called Bletchley Park in those days. It was Station X, and that was that, yes.
Which is the same as a few weeks ago, we went down to a memorial plaque being opened at Eastcote, at the bomb, the outstation.
Yes,
and all the ladies know that as Pembroke 5.
That was the Wrens, you see. Although we were nowhere near the Navy or anything else, we had to have our pay accounts held in a ship. I mean, every shore establishment was a ship. And ours was HMS Pembroke 5. I mean, it wasn't a place, it wasn't anything. It was just where all our records were kept.
It was the same. My stepfather was Fleet Air Arm, and I couldn't understand why he'd been on an HMS Kestrel and HMS something else. And then I did a bit of investigation, and they were land bases. A lot of people don't realise that.
No, everywhere was HMS something. In fact, if you walked out of the gate of your establishment, you were ashore. And when you came back, you were back on board. And you wouldn't say to your friend, you know, what time did you come in last night? You'd say, what time did you come off? Meaning offshore, you see.
And even in your billets, everything was...
Everything was naval.
And where were you billeted?
Woburn Abbey.
And did you have a nice part of Woburn Abbey or one of the less nice parts of Woburn Abbey?
Well, I don't know if there were any less nice. I mean, they had stripped out all the furniture, carpets and pictures. It was just a bare, bleak stone building, where we clattered up and down stone stairs and all that sort of thing, and there was no heat, and we slept right up under the roof, where it was terribly hot and terribly cold and terribly crowded, because they managed to fit... We all slept in double-decker bunks in those days, and they managed to fit four double-decker bunks into what would have been probably a maid's bedroom up under the roof. And there was just no space at all. Luckily, eight of us all got on well together. If we hadn't, it would have been... sheer hell.
You had to, didn't you?
You
really
had to. We did. And some of us became such friends that we met forever after, once a year in London. We all got together and had a good old natter.
I think most of the veterans that I've spoken to, it's the same. Because you were all forced together,
yes,
those friendships that you made then, yes, you kept for life.
Absolutely for life. And we were more like sisters than just friends. We knew all about each other's wives and we'd gone through our lives together. You know, who'd got engaged, who was having a baby, who was, you know, the whole thing. And of course, sadly now, one's died and one's got dementia and one's in a wheelchair, so our little crowd have rather shriveled. Yes, so...
What did you do after the war?
Well, I stayed on in the Wrens. In fact, I served for 8 years altogether. And I only left then because I got married. And as I married somebody in the Navy, and the Admiralty wouldn't let husbands and wives serve in the same place, bad for discipline, you know. So if you were never going to see him again, what was the point of marrying the man, you know? So you left promptly.
What did you do in the Wrens after the war?
Well, immediately afterwards, some of us were going to go to Ceylon, and we got literally to the eve of sailing, and it was troop ships, of course, then, not flying, when it was put off. And we were told, yes, you will go, but not yet, so we had to wait, and we did pretty well nothing for about 4 months. And then they said they wanted less people, and I and my particular friends never went. So then we had to change again to something else, and we became what were known as pay writers, which meant you worked in a pay office. And I worked in one at Chatham, which was set up to deal with men being demobbed, because every naval rating had a home port.
Yes.
And to be demobbed, they all came back to their home port. So all their papers, their pay, everything came back to us, and we had to sort of sort it out, and they got their demob suits and one thing and another, and then walked out of the gate.
You and your friends must have been very popular. Finally getting those men out of service.
Well, you didn't notice it, but maybe we were.
I do remember a very sad case of a young girl who told a GI at a GI dance which we attended roughly what she was doing. And that young man, to his eternal credit, went straight to his commanding officer and explained what had happened. And we never saw that nice girl again, and I just hope her life wasn't ruined by what was a very understandable slip, however much we've been brainwashed into keeping mum.
Okay, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to hand over to Catherine now, who's organising everything else.
What we'll do now, we'll get the ladies over to the bay window for a photo opportunity.
Seven of you here today is absolutely amazing. And how did it feel for you today?
Very interesting and very surprising, because mostly old people just feel old. You're like an old chair or something, you know. There's nothing specifically wonderful about being old.
That's what my mum said the other day, actually, bless her. I said, are you happy, mum? And she said, well, by happy, what do you mean?
Yes.
You know, and...
Oh, I know, yes, she sounds great,
I think it's probably a surprise for you that people half your age are so fascinated by something that you did 70
years ago. It is extraordinary, it is. But it is one of the things you remember when you're feeling very low, that there was a moment when, even if I'd been a hopeless wife and a lousy mother, there was one moment when I did something which was really useful.
Oh, without doubt. I mean, we say this to every single veteran we speak to, and so many of you say the same thing, I didn't do anything important.
No.
Every single one of you was important, because you were all one tiny cog
in
this big, massive machine.
That's it, yes.
I mean, for you, specifically, the big machine,
that's it.
Quite real, because you were one of the first computer operators in the world,
absolutely,
weren't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. Can't work the oven at home.
Well, you didn't need to. You've been there, seen that, done it. You couldn't have known what you were doing would have such consequences, really,
no,
I suppose.
No.
I mean, did you realise at the time, obviously, that you were doing something really important?
Oh, without doubt, because where I worked in the Newmanry, and Professor Newman was a very distinguished Cambridge professor, he believed in giving you at least the impression that you were being kept in their confidence, and that we were being told stuff. And I'm sure we were never told anything really dangerous, but he did hold regular meetings to say what the result of the messages that we'd netted had been in terms of damage to the enemy.
I mean, you said about this in the press conference yes. earlier, didn't you? And that's the first I've ever heard of that.
Yes, that is true. I promise you that is true.
Oh, no,
I
believe you. I mean, was it quite general or was it quite specific at times?
No, I think mostly general. But I do seem to remember the sinking of those two ships. But it could have been something I'd heard. As I say, I haven't looked up the dates. But there were these two German battleships, I think, the Scharnhorst and the Gneisenau, yes. they were called. And Bletchley was
directly responsible for
directly thinking, responsible.
Yeah.
But of course, as you know, a lot of the material we got couldn't be used, as in the evidence of Crete, which
yes.
you will have heard about, yes.
So when did you first come to Bletchley?
I came straight from university, and I suppose it was about 1943. It must have been, yes.
And did you join up, or were you drafted?
No, I was made to... I'd just come down from Oxford, and I wanted to do something interesting in the
yeah.
Foreign Office. But my mother said, it's time you had some discipline. And she thought I'd meet a better class of person if I joined the Wrens than if I joined...
Well, I should imagine the Wrens gave you some discipline, because it wasn't an easy life as a Wren. Were you in Woburn Abbey?
Yes, I was.
It wasn't the stately home it was. It
jolly
is now,
well
was
wasn't.
It?
No, but we had a lot of fun. And I think I've already narrated to somebody how the senior officer gave me her uniform to take to the cleaners. This was too much of an opportunity. I put it on and greyed my hair with talcum powder and stalked round the abbey running my finger along things and telling the cooks their food was disgusting, they must do better on all their better ingredients. And there was some final marvellous moment when a chinless wonder of a young man was standing by the front door saying, excuse me, but I'm looking for Wren Hoodrum Flipcock. And I said to him, hold your tongue, you insolent young puppy. It was my finest hour. And the chin disappeared into the neck then, absolutely. It was a wonderful moment.
Wonderful.
But we did have a lot of fun.
You had to, because your actual working conditions, it was so monotonous, I imagine.
So monotonous and hot and uncomfortable. And food was pretty nasty. But
I think that's what a lot of the ladies that we speak to
yeah.
remember, whether they're crossus
yes.
operators like you were or
yes.
bomb operators.
Yes.
It's the environment that they were in.
Yes.
That's what they remember, you know,
absolutely.
How hot it was, all the lights,
yes.
how dreadful the lights
yes.
were.
Mm, they were. But we were in the Newmanry, as it was called. We were treated with not familiarity, but great respect, and that made it all very much easier. And, of course, girls are gregarious by nature, and we're all great friends.
And I bet you kept those friends for life, didn't you?
Yes, many of them. Many of them.
This
kept
is what
for
all
life.
Of our ladies say. You,
isn't
you
really,
were
isn't
thrown together.
Yes.
And it was like a family, wasn't it?
It was like a family, and it was a crucial moment. Many girls came straight from school. As I said, I'd been to university, so I was that much older.
Mm.
But getting away from mum and fetching the fish on Tuesday and all the stuff you do at home, you know.
A lot of ladies say to me it was a big adventure.
Because that's right.
Obviously for yourself, you'd been to university,
yeah.
you left home, but a lot of the
yeah.
girls hadn't left home, had they?
Hadn't left home, honestly. And there were some who were more innocent than you'd believe possible. One little 17-year-old, you know, really didn't know what men for, she said.
And did you ever sneak out and get down to London or things
oh,
like that?
All the time, yes.
Did you?
Yes. The dodge was to find a stopping train and one that was followed fairly quickly by another. So you could stop at one of the little stations on the way to London, I forget what they were called, or on the way to Oxford. One called Parsley Hay I used to use on the way to Oxford. And you had to make sure there was another train coming along behind. You got out. You changed out of your uniform, you stuffed it in the manger, put on your glad rags, which you brought in a plastic, or the equivalent of a plastic bag, and went up to London all glamorous for your evening out. But of course it depended on being certain that on the way back the train would, the same operation
yes.
could be repeated.
There was ladies that came back on the milk train, weren't there?
Straight into work.
Park,
yes, absolutely.
And looking a little bit too glamorous for
yes,
a day.
Yes, absolutely. But luckily, a lot of the officers had no idea what we got up to. And it was part of the fun, really.
And do you look back, in general, that it was fun?
I look back that it was fun, and I look back at the fact that whatever other nonsense I'd made, I did once do something valuable for my country.
Your service was invaluable, and thank you so much for your service.
Well, you know, it was lucky that we came to such an unusual and really rather sparkly place, even though we weren't allowed to see much of it. It was fun being here. The vibes were very good.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, veterans and visitors who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk, find us on iTunes and Twitter, where we are at BPark Podcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audio Boom, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. And if you like the Bletchley Park podcast, don't be shy, write a review on iTunes. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.